Okay, Hare Krishna. So today, we are continuing with our Janmashtami lead-up classes. As I'm sure we all know now, that the concept of this year's lead-up classes is the notion of rasa. Rasa meaning mellow, and the different types of relationships that Krishna can have with his devotees. And today, we're looking at the concept of vatsalya rasa, that's parental love for Krishna. And very much exemplified through the case of Mother Yashoda. So on that note, we are reading today from Canto 10, Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 10, Chapter 9, Verse 20. Neither Lord Brahma, nor Lord Shiva, nor even the Goddess of Fortune, who is always the better half of the Supreme Lord, can obtain from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the deliverer from this material world, such mercy as received by Mother Yashoda. Purport given by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada ki. This is a comparative study between Mother Yashoda and other devotees of the Lord. As stated in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi 5.142, Ekaleshwar Krishna Arashava Britto. The only Supreme Master is Krishna, and all others are His servants. Krishna has the transcendental quality of Britya Vasyata. Vasyata. Becoming subordinate to his Britya, or servant. Now, although everyone is Britya, and although Krishna has the quality of becoming subordinate to his Britya, the position of Mother Yashoda is the greatest. Lord Brahma is Britya, a servant of Krishna, and he is Adi Kavi, the original creator of this universe. Tene Brahma Hridaya Adi Kavaye. Nonetheless, even he could not obtain such mercy as Mother Yashoda. As for Lord Shiva, he is the topmost Vaishnav. Vaishnavanam yatha shambhu. What to speak of Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva? The goddess of fortune Lakshmi is the Lord's constant companion in service, since she always associates with his body. But even she could not get such mercy. Therefore Maharaj Parikshit was surprised, thinking, what did Mother Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj do in their previous lives, by which they got such a great opportunity, the opportunity to be the affectionate father and mother of Krishna? In this verse, there are three negative pronouncements. Na, na, na. When anything is uttered three times, do it, do it, do it. One should understand that this is meant to indicate great stress on a fact. In this verse, we find na le bire, na le bire, na le bire. Yet Mother Yashoda is in the supermost exalted position, and thus Krishna has become completely subordinate to her. The word vimuktidat is also significant. There are different types of liberation, such as sayujya, salokya, sarupya, sarshti, and samipya. But vimukti means special mukti. When after liberation one is situated on the platform of prema bhakti, one is said to have achieved vimukti, special mukti. Therefore the word na is mentioned. That exalted platform of prema is described by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as prema pumartu mahan, and Mother Yashoda naturally acts in such an exalted position in loving affairs. She is therefore a nitya siddha devotee, an expansion of Krishna's ladini potency, his potency to enjoy transcendental bliss through expansions who are special devotees, ananda chinmaya rasa pratibhavita bihi. Such devotees are not sadhana siddha. Hare Krishna. So, thank you for having me to render some service on this special day, day before Lord Krishna appears in our vision on this earth. Yeah, I say this every single time, but the fact is I'm not qualified to be speaking on this verse. I did not choose this verse. This is not the normal chronological Bhagavatam verses. This verse is highly esoteric. It's thanks to Kamal Prabhu, who chose it for me. So I'll do my best to try and say something on it and make things as simple as possible. I'd like to obviously ask everyone's blessings, all the Vaishnavas assembled here, and also those who are watching online as well. Yesterday I was having a chat with Srinivas Prabhu as well, to, you know, and give me some pointers that I can work on for this class, because I think it's the most esoteric verse I've ever had to speak on. So, okay, so as I mentioned, we are looking at Vatsalya Ras now, okay? Of the, you know, yesterday Purojana Prabhu spoke about Madhura Ras, which is the conjugal loving relationships that Krishna has with his devotees. Before that, of course, we had Gaudruma Prabhu and Jai Krishna Prabhu, Sakya Ras. Jai Krishna Prabhu spoke on Sakya Ras, and Gaudruma Prabhu spoke on Dasya Ras as well. These rasas are obviously the different types of relationships Krishna has, and it what makes our Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition so unique that we can access such a deep relationship with Krishna of such different natures. One would find it very hard to find any other spiritual tradition that will go so deep into finding such a variety of relationships that one can have with God. So here it's looking at, firstly, let's look at this in sections. So first thing is we're looking at the highest type of devotees and their mood. So there was a lecture by Srila Prabhupada, an excerpt of which was in a Back to Godhead article from 1992. And it was a comparative study where Prabhupada mentions there are some devotees who consider Krishna to be the Supreme Lord versus those who don't consider him to be the Supreme Lord. Who are the highest? Who are the higher out of those two groups? Those who consider Krishna to be the Supreme Lord and those who don't consider him to be the Supreme Lord. The ones who don't. Yes, that's correct. The latter are considered higher. Which is interesting because it's mentioned, we know as well, Prabhupada also mentioned in the article that Krishna is obviously the ultimate creator. Everything's coming from him. And obviously he has many devotees that then obviously work on his behalf. Right? For example, we have Yamaraj, who's the Lord of Death. He's doing his job, but there's always a tinge of fear for Yamaraj that he's doing his job because obviously he's a devotee of Krishna, but there's some element of fear as to, you know, that I'm doing my job because I have to do my job because, you know, he's my Lord, you know. Suryadev is obviously sustaining the planets, you know, through his sunshine, which of course he wants to do, but there's also a tinge of fear there. It may not necessarily be tinged directly of fear of Krishna himself, but of maybe reactions of if I don't do my duty, then what would happen? Right, so there's still some fear there, indirect fear of Krishna or direct fear of Krishna. Okay, and similarly, all the demigods, they're all doing their duties, but there's always a tinge of fear. But when one looks at the Vrajabasis, they worship Krishna, not necessarily as his Lord, as their Lord, but as their intimate friend, as their lover, and therefore it's actually considered higher. They're not looking for any kind of sustenance, safety, making sure that I don't get any bad reactions and things like that, is because they just want to, regardless of whether it's, you know, whether it's like materially beneficial or not, it doesn't matter anymore, okay? And we know the supremacy of Raj, Vrajdes, because we have, of course, Kunti Devi, Queen Kunti. She was a resident of Hastinapur, which is the royal palace. But she used to worship the residents of Vrindavan. But the Vrajabasis didn't. The Vrajabasis didn't worship the residents of Hastinapur. So it didn't go two ways. That means there is a superiority there. Okay, so for the Vrajabasi mood, their mood is that they're not really looking at Krishna's opulences. They just want to love Krishna. Okay, that's their main mood. And that's why it's a bit more high intimacy. On a more mundane level, Prabhupada often gives the example. This is a quite common one. I'm sure a lot of us have heard of this. Was the old British Prime Minister William Gladstone, and he when the minister went to see him at his office, and the secretary said, "I'm sorry, but Prime Minister is busy right now," and so he's taking ages inside the office, thinking, "What's going on? What's he taking so long? He's not meant to be having a meeting now or something." Then he looks through the keyhole, and what does he see? He looks through the keyhole of the Prime Ministerial office. Yes, that's right. Thank you, Venugopal Prabhu. So he's seeing William Gladstone, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, right? And he's basically on his all fours, on the ground, playing horseback with his grandkids that are on top of him. So that means Gladstone deemed that to be more important, more precious to him than having a very, prim and proper ministerial meeting, you know? So the same way, we can see that the same relationship is with Krishna, that when we have our intimate relationship with Krishna, that's actually what attracts Krishna more than the opulence, than just dharma, than just, you know, maintaining the cosmos and things like that. Even though nothing happens without a sanction. Bhagavad Gita says, right? Aham sarvasya prabhavo mata sarvam pravartate. Everything is emanating from him, all the spiritual and material worlds, etc. Okay? So, and also we can see that there are also differences in intimacy into how we can approach Krishna. In the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, there's example of Gopakumar. And Gopakumar is traveling around the whole cosmos and into the spiritual world. Brihat Bhagavatamrita is, by the way, like a book, like the Bhagavatam, like a spiritual book compiled by Sanatan Goswami, who's one of our main Goswamis. And then he goes to Vaikuntha. And at Vaikuntha, he sees Lord Vishnu, and he knows that obviously Lord Vishnu is actually Krishna, his dearmost Lord. So he starts calling Vishnu by these intimate names like Govinda and Gopal. And all these Vaikuntha buses like, what are you doing? Why are you calling him by that name? Because for them, it's too intimate for them. Because, you know, their mood is like, it's, you know, royal, regal, majestic. You know, you don't just call our Lord Vishnu Gopal, you know? That's just like, you know, like a coward boy or something, you know? And then it goes on and even more than when, even in Dwarka, which is considered to be more intimate because now Krishna's as himself, but it's still a bit more regal because it's not quite Vrindavan, even though it's Krishna himself. And there, Gopakumar comes because, you know, he's like a cowherd boy, right? So he's coming in the dress of a cowherd boy, and the Dwarka Vasis are telling him, you know, maybe you want to change your clothes, you know, you're in a palace now. Like, even that's too intimate, you know, like, he has to be dressed like a prince, you know, you're going to see the king of Dwarka here, you know? So you can see that there's difference in intimacies as well. We're very lucky, actually, in our Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, as being Krishna Bhaktas, that we can actually access, I'm not saying we're there yet, but we can access that kind of Krishna in his most intimate form, as obviously when we get sufficiently advanced. You know, even if you look at Lord Ram, Lord Ram is obviously also very, very intimate form of the Lord. But if you look at Lord Ram's childhood pastimes, he's very much looked after, but he's never actually let out of the palace. It's not that he can just associate as a little kid with everyone. Whereas you look at Krishna, he's associating with everyone from like since he's a toddler. He's going, you know, associating with the monkeys, the gopas, the gopis. He's, you know, like, you know, walking around the village, like talking to all the elderly gopis and the elderly farmers and everything. Like, you know, from right from the beginning, Krishna is associating with everyone. So that shows that Krishna is more approachable even than Lord Ram, right? So therefore, we have that, obviously, that kind of luxury that we have. So, yeah, so that's the whole point. And obviously, what Gopakumar's example shows is that there's a bit more of a spontaneous mood there when one is accessing Krishna within this path of bhakti to Krishna. Okay, so now, according to the purport, we can look at some specialities of some intimate relationships. First, we want to look at these types of liberations. So here it's talked about key liberations, five types of liberations. Sayujya, Sarupya, Salokya, Sarshti, and Samipya. And maybe some of you have heard of these five types of liberations. We'll go through them one by one. So Sayujya liberation. Does anyone know what Sayujya liberation is? Yes, Godrima Prabhu. That's right, merging into the body of Krishna. Can I give you an example of famous personality? Yes, Rasaraj Prabhu. Yes, Shishupal. Anyone? Agasura. Yes. In fact, a lot of the, you know, those types of people, the demons basically, who had their interaction with Krishna would end up in this liberation. Kamsa, right? Classic one. So yes, Sayujya liberation is one. Sarupya. The clue is in the name, Rupa. Sarupya, yes, Babaji. Yes, attains a similar form as Krishna. Salokya. Yes, same again. The clue is in the name. Lokya. Yeah, Salokya, same abode as the Lord. Sarshti. Same opulence as, yes, Prabhuji. Very good. And Samipya. Yes, Rasa Raj Prabhu. Yes, personal association of the Lord. Example of this, of course, is Prabhupada specifically mentions Arjun. He attained this Samipya liberation. So it says that of this Sayujya is, in one sense, the lowest, actually. Prabhupada said that this type of liberation for devotees, it's akin to going to hell, actually, merging into the body of Krishna. And we know this because if we look at it philosophically speaking, we know that there are three types. These are five types of liberation. There are also another scale of three types of God realization: Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. And they say that there are three functions of the soul. Do we know what those are? The three main properties of the soul? Satchitananda, right? Eternity, knowledge, and bliss. When one attains Brahman realization, they've attained the Sat aspect of their soul's propensities. When they've attained Paramatma realization, they would have attained the Chit aspect, the all-knowing, all-cognitive aspect. But until one has attained Bhagavan, one cannot experience the Ananda aspect, which is bliss, which is love. So until one is attaining the Bhagavan, which one can only get through a personal relationship, one will always, always be dissatisfied. That's why these, whether it's, Sayujya or all these other types of liberations, they won't give the full, satisfaction until one is having that personal relationship with Krishna. So we're coming more close to Yashoda Mai because that's what we're going to talk about more. I'm just giving a bit of a background based on the purport. We also talked about the concept of rasa. We're going to talk about the concept of rasa here. So can someone tell us what rasa means? Taste, mood, mellow, all these kind of things. It's a type of like your emotions in which you're relating to someone, right? According to the Tattatreya Upanishad, there's a famous quote, I'm sure a lot of you have heard this, raso vesa. Raso vesa means the ultimate reality is rasa, or spiritual experience. And it's only this that actually gives us the highest bliss. So we know that ultimately for us to practice Krishna consciousness, we cannot jump to the rasa aspect straight away. That's very dangerous. Okay? That's very dangerous. But ultimately, we often talk about how, first we have to spiritualize our intelligence. We have to develop the tattva understanding, the philosophical understanding. We have to practice the process. Then gradually as time goes by, we get purified. Then we can start to delve into the realms of rasa. But the important thing is ultimately that is what we want to get to. This whole Krishna conscious practice that we're doing, it has to go beyond sadhana to the point where we are experiencing some level of rasa, some emotional connection with Krishna, not just an intellectual connection or, not even just a service connection. Service connection is there, but the service and the tattva and the gyan all has to lead to a real deep emotional connection with Krishna. And when one gets this, then what happens is all the rules of tattva can then be manipulated and adjusted, because then Krishna wants to have a emotional relationship with you. Until that point, we have to follow the rules and regulations. But when you get to the rasa aspect, then things can change a bit. So I'll give you an example just to demonstrate this more. We often talk about qualities that Krishna has, right, in the scriptures. Did you know there are 18 principal qualities that Krishna does not have? Right? There are 18 principal qualities that Krishna does not have. I'll read them out. Illusion, laziness, error, cruelty, intense lust, fickleness, arrogance, envy, violence, sorrow, fatigue, dishonesty, anger, longing, fear, confusion, partiality, depending on others. Now it's interesting. These qualities Krishna does not have. If you're looking at it from a tattva perspective, from a philosophical perspective, knowledge-based perspective. However, when you get to this level of rasa, right, Then, Krishna has been known to demonstrate some of these qualities. For example, fear. It says that Krishna doesn't possess fear. But we can think, and very much pertinent to this verse, can anyone think of an example where Krishna has demonstrated fear? Yes, Babaji. That's right, yes. Krishna shows fear to Mother Yashoda. What about, for example, it says here, sorrow or longing. Very famous epic I'm thinking of here, where, you know, a form of Krishna at least. Yes, Rasaraj Prabhu. That's right, yes. When Sita gets separated, Lord Ram's crying, he's lamenting, he's completely bewildered, he doesn't know what to do. Now, of course, we're thinking, well, hang on, he's a supreme person of Godhead. He knows everything. He's omniscient, omnipotent. How can he be so sorrowful? You know? So therefore, huh? And yes, of course, when his father died, right? There are all these examples, okay, of different ways in which Krishna expresses these kind of like so-called non-godly qualities for the sake of rasa. So, if these qualities are not within Krishna, why does Krishna then manifest these for the sake of rasa? Why would he do such qualities for the sake of rasa? Yes, it's more personal. It's to create like an emotional bond, right? Sometimes through adversity, one can create emotional bonds which are more deeper. And so therefore, the whole point, that's what Krishna wants. That's why he's also known as Rasaraj, right? He's the king of rasa. That's what he wants actually from us. He wants emotion more than anything. He prizes emotional connection more than obedience, more than just, you know, obeying and, you know, like all that kind of thing. You know, this is what he wants more. I know I'm doing being a bit philosophical, but I feel it's necessary right now. Amongst the different rasas, the ways in which Krishna relates with different devotees, obviously there will be a variety of rasa. Just like when we relate with our loved ones, it's not that we relate with the loved ones all in one emotion. Like say you relate with your mother, sometimes it will be, you know, with happiness, sometimes anger, sometimes, you know, I don't know, like whatever, different types of emotions that there could be that you can have with your mother. However, based on the person that you're relating with, there's going to be a predominant overriding emotion with that person, like your permanent default emotion with that person, right? A permanent main bhav that you have with that person, right? The main bhav you have with your brother will be slightly different from the main emotion that you have with your mother or your father, right? A predominant main emotion. This is called stayi bhava. Okay, so amongst the rasas, there are also what is called stayi bhavas. Stayi bhava is the permanent emotion, the main emotion that you have with that person, or what Krishna has with you. Okay? This leads to the attachment to Krishna, called Krishna Rati. Stayi bhava leads to Krishna Rati. That permanent emotion you have with Krishna leads to the attachment to Krishna. Okay, so with Yashoda Mai and Krishna, what is the predominant stayi bhava? What is the stayi bhava there? It's parental love, yeah? Parental love. Yes, glad you knew that one. So yes, parental love is the most powerful one. It's such a real one, and it's the motherly need. And we can see that even in the mature world, that motherly affection is, you know, obviously gets reflected even in the mature world. And even here we can see that it's so powerful. That motherly need. Often you can see, like, even amongst animals, you know, like, you know, the affections that mothers have for the children. What to speak of amongst humans, even amongst animals. There are cases where, you know, like there's, the farm collapsed. There was this example, I can't remember the reference for it, but there was a farm that was collapsing. The planks were dropping down and there was a hen with her chicklets. The hen knows there's no chance that, you know, the hen's going to survive with her chicklets. These big, big planks are falling off the ceiling. She still spread her wings to cover her chicklets, knowing that she's going to die and her chicklets are going to die. But just through that motherly bond, she decided to protect those chicklets anyway, right? And that motherly bond, it's It's not even but not always like, you know, just like your own children. Sometimes, you know, like that motherly bond may be there even if, like, say, the person's not a mother. Like, you know, I don't know if you remember this, a few years back, they used to be in the newspaper, came along about in the wild where there was a lioness and it somehow befriended a deer, like a little deer fawn, and started looking after the deer like it's her own. Now, generally, lions eat deers, right? Like antelopes, gazelles, whatever. But this lioness was actually looking after the fawn like it's her own. So this shows that the motherly need is there. It's actually there. That emotion, that bhav, that motherly affection is there present within us. Now, of course, in the mature world, yes, scientists may argue, or, you know, mundane-minded people may argue that, oh, but, you know, it's just hormones and chemicals that are combining to create that mood. No, the hormones and chemicals are there to facilitate that emotion to come through, but it's just to facilitate the emotion to come through. But the emotion is there. It needs to come out somewhere or another, right? So the scientific things are there just to kind of help to bring it out, but the emotions are there underlying there anyway, right? Jai Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda ki, Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman ji ki, Sri Sri Gaunitai ki. So that need, that motherly affection is very much presence. That need to look after someone who's completely helpless and dependent on you. It's one of the most powerful bonds that we probably have in the material world. Okay? So therefore, naturally, that is also coming from the spiritual world as well. Okay? And who is the epitome of this motherly love? Mother Yashoda, right? She's the source of this motherly affection. And all the other gopis, the elderly gopis, they also have some of this vatsalya ras, but it's coming from her. Like, you know, she's the center of it. She's the apex of that motherly love. So now we're going to talk about Mother Yashoda. So Mother Yashoda, let's look at the word. Yashoda is the ashraya of prema, meaning that she's the shelter of prema. Yashoda Mai is ashraya. She's the shelter of prema. Krishna is the Vishaya. He's the object of the prema. Okay, so Mother Yashoda is the one giving the shelter to the love. Krishna is the object of that love. And it says that through Yashoda Mai's devotion, she's actually giving fame to Krishna, as well as to Nanda Maharaj, and as well as to the whole lineage. In fact, her name, Yasha, means fame. Da means to give. So she actually gives fame. She gives fame to Krishna, to her husband, to the family lineage, everything. Okay? Prabhupada mentions that Mother Yashoda's love is unmatched in its purity, and it's unlike any other. It's unlike any other, that even the infinite Lord who pervades the entire creation is bound by her love. Okay? And then Prabhupada goes on to say in a lecture in 1973, because mother loves the most, in this mature world, there is no comparison of a mother's love. Without any exchange, there's no exchange going on in a mother's love, isn't it? It's pretty much one-sided, right? Even in this mature world, mother loves the child without any expectation of return generally. That is called unalloyed love, anabilasita sunyam, free from all material gain. And it's true, even in a mature world, right? You know, sometimes what moms have to go through, like, you know, when the kids are growing up and the kids are getting stroppy and things like that, or they're coming home like late, from, I don't know, frolicking about with their friends, coming back at night at 2 o'clock in the morning, and the mother's still anxiously, like, you know, like looking around, waiting up. She can't sleep properly because she's concerned that where's my baby? You know, the baby's probably like a little brat right now. Sorry, I'm being cheeky here. But you know what I mean? I'm talking from personal experience as well, of course. I am the brat, of course. But like this, you know, the mother, right? You know, she takes so much from the kids, right? She takes so much, but she doesn't actually wane in her love, her devotion, things like that, okay? So that's why in this purport it says amongst all the servants, Mother Yashoda is the best, okay? To be a mother is such a deep connection. In fact, in Bengali culture, it said that when a child gets married, the mother, you know, when the child gets married, in the marriage ceremony, when the bride and the groom are actually, you know, tying the knot, so to speak, the mother, at least in Bengali custom, I'm not saying in all customs, but the mother turns her gaze away, or actually just comes out of that ceremony for that bit. The reason being, it's said because it's so painful for the mother, because it's a, there's a Bengali term like atta. Atta means atma, like soul pain. Like, it's a pain of the soul, because you know the baby's coming from the mother's body, right? So it's like, it's almost like you're connected with that child on such a deep level that when you see that child and getting married, it's almost like part of your soul is now being given away to someone else, because you know the bride or the groom's going to take away that your child. So the mother actually turns away, A, because it's so hurtful, and to avoid her actually displaying any jealous feelings towards the bride or the groom. Which is interesting, actually, because, okay, you might see it as old wives' tale, but actually, that's quite an the whole jealousy between the mother-in-law and the daughter-in-law is quite a common thing in cultures. You know, we have so many Indian films and serials and stories where there's always a special rasa going on between the mother-in-law and the daughter-in-law. So maybe there's a ring of truth there. So they say that in Bengali culture, the mother averts the gaze or just comes out of the thing and then comes back in, you know, once that bit's done. So anyway, interesting. Okay, so Mother Yashoda. So in this, obviously, this chapter, Mother Yashoda is binding Lord Krishna. Obviously, we know that this from the Damodar pastime. And it describes Mother Yashoda. She's darkish. She's perspiring. She's got a few grey hairs. Mother Yashoda's got a few grey hairs. She's got a somewhat heavy, plump body, right? And when she's running, she's perspiring. She's, you know, she's sweating and everything like that. There's no sense of, like, you know, keeping up appearances here. There's no sense of like enticements for serving Krishna here. It's not that by serving Krishna I'm going to become beautiful and this. And I mean, she is beautiful, of course, but she's not concerned about how she's looking right now. You know, because she's in a bit of a kind of like a flustered state. It doesn't matter though. It's for Krishna, right? It's completely for Krishna. And what is she doing as she's actually binding Krishna, or even before binding, when she's actually churning the milk? You know, the whole Damodar pastime is described. This is from Bhakti Purushottam Maharaj's book on Sri Damodar. Her hands and body are involved in making the butter for Krishna. While she's doing that, her tongue is singing about Krishna. Her ears are hearing the song she's singing about Krishna. And her mind is thinking about how can she make this makhan, this butter, even better for Krishna. To the point where she even chooses what grass the cows eat so that the milk that's coming from that cows is going to produce the best quality butter. So from this, we can see that every single part of her senses, her mind, her hands, her body, her ears, her tongue, it's all engaged completely for Krishna's pleasure. Nothing for herself. Okay? Radhanath Marj, he also mentions that the mother, the relationship between Krishna and his mother, and he's specifically referring to Sachi Mata and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Of course, Sachi Mata is also Mother Yashoda. That the tears of separation, which are based on knowledge and truth, between Sachi Mata and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, are the most elevated and purifying of spiritual experiences. And the reciprocation, same thing can be applied to Mother Yashoda. And the reciprocation that is going on between them is of an extremely intense level. There's one time when Sachi Mata, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is going to take sannyas, I'm sure Jay Krishna Prabhu knows this, he's done this play quite a few times. I remember when I first joined the manor, I took part in the Mahaprabhu taking sannyas play as well. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Sachi Mata says to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu that, Nimai, I'll take poison and end my life. Please don't take sannyas. Because, you know, the motherly love cannot bear to see the child go away and not see him again. And Mahaprabhu says, my mother, I'll never leave you. You are my mother, birth after birth. I promise you this, that whenever you think of me, you will see me within your heart. Whenever you cook for me, you will feel my presence taking the prasadam you've prepared. I'll not abandon you. Right? This is very deep. God himself is saying that I'll always be with you, always. And this is the example. And obviously, Sachi Mata eventually accepted Mahaprabhu to take sannyas. Obviously, she made sure that Mahaprabhu always stays in Jagannath Puri. So she gets news of Mahaprabhu's adventures and pastimes and things like that. Prabhupada says this is an example of perfect motherhood, because a mother does not want to see their child go away. But at the same time, they know that for the child to fulfill their destiny, especially when they're talking from a Krishna conscious perspective, which in many cases might mean taking sannyas, the mother has to let the child go. Otherwise, they will also get infamy from, and Prabhupada says this, the saintly personalities. You know, the sadhus were very stern and they'll look down upon the mother like, how can you just mollycoddle your child and let her stay here when, you know, he should be out there going taking sannyas. It's interesting, Sutapa just came here. He's going to be taking sannyas soon. I'm sure his mother's obviously, if she's aware of it. But anyway, so through this, so Prabhupada's instruction for motherhood was a perfect mother is one that lets the child go to fulfill their destiny so as to not accrue any blame from the elderly saintly personalities. So there you can see Sati Mata had so much separation. But what about Mother Yashoda? If you think about it, her separation was even more. Sati Mata, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took sannyas when he was about 24, if I'm correct, 24 years old, right? And of course, even after taking sannyas, he stayed in Jagannath Puri, predominantly. So Sati Mata can still get some knowledge as to what he's up to. Mother Yashoda, what age was Krishna when Krishna left Vrindavan? Permanently, you know, after Akrura took him away. 11 years old, right? That, and then from that point onwards, pretty much, for the rest of the time, Mother Yashoda, at least on the earthly plane, Mother Yashoda was not really seeing Krishna. After that, Krishna is fully settled in Dwarka, doing the whole Mahabharata pastimes, everything like that. So you can imagine, Mother Yashoda, so much love, and yet made the supreme sacrifice of not seeing her dear boy, the love of her life, her everything, from 11 years old onwards. Okay, so this shows the level. So this is, there's love in connection, and of course there's also love in separation. Love in separation is not just the gopis, the Madhura Bhav. Even within the Vatsalya Rasa, we can see there's intense love in separation going on here. Okay, so anyway, we've talked a lot about the tattva behind it and everything like that. So I'm just going to talk a little bit esoteric here, not too much, so don't worry. But in terms of Mother Yashoda's love, this is from Damodar Janani, which is a book written by Shivaram Maharaj on the Damodar pastime. It says that just like in a material world, you know, one of the bonds that a mother and a child develop is, you know, through the physical activities of, giving milk to the child and things like that. So same way, there was a strong bond between Krishna and Mother Yashoda when Mother Yashoda is breastfeeding Krishna. But it says that when Krishna is drinking the milk, it's not just milk. Well, actually, it's described as ambrosial milk. But it's also that milk is representing the liquid form of Mother Yashoda's maternal love. Now, we have to be very advanced to understand what this means. I'm not entirely sure, but I'm just conveying what it says here. And through that whole activity, there's almost like a rivalry going on between the more Mother Yashoda is giving milk, the more Krishna is receiving. And it's almost like the love between them is just increasing more and more and more. Okay? And it's said here that this whole Damodar Janani pastime, Krishna agreed to be bound by Mother Yashoda due to her love. And here's the interesting thing. This was not meant to be part of a pastime. It's just because Mother Yashoda wanted it. Meaning that, you know, sometimes when Krishna comes, he performs pastimes to demonstrate certain messages, right? Just demonstrate certain lessons for us to be learnt, right? And often these pastime, you know, it's almost like they've kind of like worked out that, yes, I'm going to be having this pastime. This one, we call it a pastime because we can learn so much from it. It was never meant to be a pastime. It was simply because Mother Yashoda wanted it, so Krishna reciprocated. Now it's become a pastime in our culture. But it wasn't actually meant to be a pastime. So that just shows the level of connection between Mother Yashoda and Krishna. It said at one point when Mother Yashoda's churning the milk to make the butter, and you know Krishna as a baby is trying to stop Mother Yashoda from churning. You know, and obviously the pastime is that, you know, obviously Mother Yashoda, Krishna's like wants full attention to Mother Yashoda. But on a deeper level, Krishna's actually telling Mother Yashoda that, why are you churning? Why are you churning? The gyanis churn. Right? The gyanis are always churning because they're always trying to get more and more meanings from the scriptures. Right? They're always trying to get the essence of the scriptures. You already have me. Why are you churning? You don't need to churn anymore. You've already got me. The gyanis need to churn because they haven't got me yet. But you've already got me. So isn't that sweet? That, you know, that she's already got him. That's why you don't need to churn anymore. Okay? And then even like, for example, we know the classic one about the yogis, how Mother Yashoda, Krishna allows himself to be caught by Mother Yashoda out of love. Even the yogis whose minds can go, you know, who can travel as fast as the mind, they can't get fast enough into the Brahman, right? But even they're not able to catch Krishna, but Mother Yashoda is. Here, in the purport, Prabhupada also mentions how even Lakshmiji's love for Krishna, considering Lakshmiji is constantly with Krishna in Vishnu form, is not as high as Mother Yashoda's. So it's said that Lakshmiji's mood towards Vishnu, Krishna, is, I am all yours. I am yours, which means that I'm aware of all your power and your opulence, therefore I'm surrendering unto you, I'm yours. But Yashoda Mai's is not the same. Yashoda Mai's, you are all mine. Okay, Krishna is only mine. He has no other shelter but me. I have to always look after him. Bhakti Purushottam Maharaj, he gives the term mamata. Mamata means just mine, purely mine. That goes even higher because Mother Yashoda is not aware of the opulences of Krishna. And we know this from many, many pastimes. It's simply I'm just here to look after you because if I don't look after you, who else will look after you? You are completely helpless on me. There's no sense of opulence, awareness. Because even if you're aware of someone's power, it's not fully selfless. There was a tinge of like, I know how big this guy is. You know, I know how strong and powerful this person is, you know. I'm aware of it, you know. That's why you need to see often like, you know, rich people, they try to hide their richness so that when they know that if someone's being friends with them, it's because of them, you know, and not because they got loads of money. Later on, they might reveal they got loads of money. You know, we see that. I'm sure Godrima Prabhu does a lot of preaching with the people who have got lots of money, but I guess they get taken in by Godrima Prabhu because he doesn't care about the money. He just tells them straight about Krishna consciousness. Then later they may all get inspired to then donate loads of money, right? It's the same here as well. Right, Krishna loves Yashoda so deeply because he knows that Yashoda Mai is giving him all the love with no knowledge of how powerful he is. Okay, so anyway, there we go. We've got glorification of Vatsalya Ras of Yashoda Mai, and obviously it says here that she's a Nitya Siddha. People might ask, how can she be Nitya Siddha since we know that she was also Dhara, you know, in a previous life? But anyway, that's up to you if you want to ask. But she's a Nitya Siddha, and it requires humility on our part because we can never be Yashoda Mai. Obviously, as we progress, we may experience some levels of Vatsalya Rasa as we get more and more advanced. But Yashoda Mai is Yashoda Mai. There's only one Yashoda Mai. And obviously, what we've talked about today and the last few days, these are very high concepts, these rasas. So for us, obviously, we have to remember that we must get the tattva in first. We must stick with the basics, right? Stick with our sambandha, knowing what our sambandha is, right? Knowing what our prayojana is, and then practicing the abhideya. Stick with the basics for now, and as time goes by, then these things may come and become more apparent to us, because often what happens, even when we come to Krishna consciousness, sometimes we might get flickerings of deep reciprocation with Krishna. And in many cases it could be too, because sometimes Krishna may give you some drops of reciprocation. At the same time, don't trust your mind too much in the initial stages or your dreams. Because sometimes devotees may say, in my dream I saw this, or I came to Krishna, I saw the deities and I saw Krishna winking at me. It's like, the point is that, you know, even if there may be some flickerings of truth there in whatever reciprocation you might get, right? And, you know, you can definitely use it to inspire you to carry on, but always lean on the basics that Prabhupada gave us, right? The basics, chanting, 16 rounds, sadhana, service, all these things, right? Tadvigyartam sa gurumeva bigachet, right? Just follow what the guru is telling us. Follow in the footsteps of the Mahajans, Mahajana Yena Gatha Sapantaha. And through that, we can then progress. And then one day, we can maybe get a better understanding of these rasas that Yashoda Mai is experiencing with Krishna. But rest assured, that is the most important thing though. Rasto Vesa. That is the ultimate reality, which you one day want to come to. Thank you very much. Any comments, questions, queries? Yes, Samuel Prabhu.
Thank you for the class. And in the beginning of the class, you were talking about kind of motherly affection and the importance of this. So I was wondering for devotees, how does this apply in our lives? For example, maybe some people have strained relationships with their families because of them being royal, or even as a brahmachari, we don't associate with women so much. And then we also understand that Krishna Mata, Krishna Pita, Krishna is our mother. So, like, what's the application of this for devotees in terms of receiving that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. We have to understand that when a devotee comes to Krishna consciousness, they become brahmachari or sannyas, it's not because they're rejecting their mother. It's because they're trying to access a deeper sense of love, which will ultimately be beneficial for the mother and their loved ones, right? A sannyasi is not actually, especially in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, sannyasis are not, it's not that they're trying to negate the emotions. If anything, they're trying to actually now embrace the whole world as their family. Instead of just looking after their loved ones and their own particular family, they've taken on the whole world as their family. Now, of course, to be a brahmachari and sannyasi, it may require some distance from the family, only because, you know, you want to concentrate all your focus on the spiritual practice. And, the material bonds, motherly affections, family affections are very strong. And they can distract us from the goal. Not because they're deliberately trying to distract us, but because the emotional pulls are so strong. So maybe some distance is required, especially if you're a brahmachari, right? But understand that we're not there to reject the mother. Everything we're doing ultimately is going to benefit them as well. It's for the highest benefit for them as well. That's why Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mood is that he's saying to Sachi Mata that I'll never abandon you. I'm with you always. Every time you cook the prasadam, you'll feel my presence taking that prasadam all the time. So Mahaprabhu was also, the mood is that that I'm here with you. Even if I'm not physically with you, I'm here. So our mood should be that, and spirit, whatever spiritual practices we're doing, whatever benedictions we're getting as well, we're also passing that on to our loved ones and family. And obviously on a practical level, we should try and keep, as best as we can, keep good relations with our folks, right? Often that could be the best preaching you can do. They say that with family, with mothers, families, trying to give them philosophy is not always the ideal way, because trying to preach to your family is just like who are you? I was cleaning your diapers, and you're trying to tell me this, right? But I think if they see you becoming a better person, developing good qualities, then they will naturally think, okay, you know what? He's doing a good thing here. So I think keep good relations with them, and reassure them that whatever you're doing is for a very good benefit for them and yourself. I don't know if anyone else has anything to say on that. Yes, Godrumapur and then Sutapapur.
Thanks, Kundan. Regarding Sam's question, it's interesting because when somebody joins a temple, then it's always difficult for the family of that person, especially the mother. So we see in our own cases, or many of the devotees we know, and even like Radhanath Maharaj, he had his mother and his father. They were sort of worried about him when he's traveling and, practicing some spirituality and things. But we've seen what happened initially when devotees come and they join, and they're trying to kind of detach themselves from all worldly things so they can actually focus on Krishna and perfecting their spiritual life. And then initially there's this thing that, I don't want any of this. But when the devotee becomes more stable and more mature, actually can deal with parents and he can deal with family members, whoever it is, in a nice way, because his understanding and connection with Krishna is much deeper. So he's not so easily swayed. And actually what happens is, initially the parents, sometimes they're very much against it and they're upset and everything. But later I've seen many, many cases that they actually come around and they appreciate. So what the devotee is doing is initially getting a little bit of detachment so he can follow his path in life for cultivating attachment to Krishna, which means relative detachment from other things. But later on, it's so nice because he's actually liberating his family and his mother, you know. Otherwise, sometimes they just stay in the family and say, okay, I'll drive you to the shops and back, or I'll do this for you or that, you know. I'll wash the dishes, you know. But this one, you're getting them out the material world, you know. Mm-hmm. That's a nice service for them.
Yeah, thank you, Prabhu. Sutapa?
Thank you. Thank you, Prabhu, for the nice class. And happy appearance day to Niskanchan, Prabhu. Getting old. Prabhu, I just wondered, like, sometimes new people come, inverted commas, new people come to Krishna consciousness and they have this already rasa with Krishna. You know, sometimes they have this very kind of spontaneous treat Krishna as the young boy. And, you know, sometimes we've even been to houses where, you know, like they put Krishna into like bed at night and, you know, take him off the altar and, you know, all these kind of things. So I just wondered whether that, and just generally like some kind of seemingly very spontaneous bhava or rasa that people have towards Krishna, maybe from their childhood, and just how, as preachers, how to kind of deal with that, and you know, because in one sense, for us to judge, you know, where they're at is also dangerous. At the same time, Shruti, Shrimati, Purana, Adi, you have to do it according to regulation. That injunction is there, and they may influence others as well. So I just wondered whether you had any thoughts on that, how to deal with such situations.
That's a tricky one. When I was initially coming to Krishna consciousness, my response initially would be, you know, look, whatever they've done, is a lot of it's probably sentimental. Clear the slate. Let's start fresh, okay? We're going to do this Krishna conscious now, okay? Right? Whatever you've done. However, I feel, you mentioned it yourself as well, you know, it's very difficult for us to judge where they're at, because let's say if they have a deep connection, even if they're not practicing Krishna conscious just yet, but they might have a deep connection based on previous lives. They may have done some things which is why they've got a deep connection with Krishna, right? And so they're treating him in such a way. I think it's a case-by-case basis. If certain people have been dealing with Krishna in a certain way, based on family cultural traditions, but they weren't like, it's not that they're so emotionally vested in it, which means that they're willing to adapt and change and just refresh their approach to Krishna through the Krishna conscious way, then that's great. Then fine, you know, let's bring them in. Okay, you know Krishna is, you've been interacting with Krishna in a certain way, but, you know, we follow the scriptures. This is the way in which you can now freshly approach Krishna, right? And if they accept, and if they're ready to accept that, then great. And I think a lot of people would. You obviously will get certain people who will have attachments, deep, deep emotional attachments. I would personally say to them that, okay, if you are doing certain things for Krishna, I would leave it. I wouldn't necessarily try and, you know, yank them out of that, but at least bring in the Krishna conscious practices, like, you know, at least chanting 16 rounds, reading the scriptures every day, right? But if they're doing other things, like you mentioned, like, you know, putting Krishna to sleep, and if they're really attached to that, those kind of the intimate activities, even if it is born of sentiment, we don't want to disturb them too much, so let them carry on for a while as they're in tandem going deeper into the Krishna conscious philosophy, and then, you know, see where we can go from there. I'll give an example. There was one, Mataji. She's an initiated devotee, Loknath Maharaj disciple. She was a big Kali Bhakta, Bhaktin, right? And she very big Kali worshipper. And she came to Krishna consciousness, And, you know, then suddenly, obviously, devotees telling her, oh, yeah, you know, this is not, you know, leave this now. Maybe put it in the river, you know, put the deity of Kali in the river or something like that. And so, but then she asked a sannyasi that, what should I do? I've got such deep attachment. And the sannyasi says, no, keep Kali. You can worship Kali, but obviously worship Kali with the mood now of getting you closer to Krishna, and make sure you obviously have Krishna there, you know, in your worship. So through that, she's obviously getting more and more close to Krishna, and she's become initiated now. So I think if for some people it's a gradual process, for some people it's not about just, you know, clear it all out and just start fresh. Some people, okay, if you have this, then do it, but at least bring this in. Does that make sense, you know? Because also, like, you know, if someone has a deep attachment to something, and let's say they come to Krishna consciousness, they practice, either they themselves will realize that, actually, you know what, I know I've been doing this for some time, but you know what, actually now I'm thinking, seeing for myself that, okay, maybe I should do it this way around. This is the way I should be doing it. That's not the way. You know, you can let Krishna also help in that regard. Or possibly, maybe their intensity of what they were doing becomes very, very like spiritual and mystical, which maybe what they were doing, whatever activity they were doing, was actually for some deep devotion they had from a previous time, and now it actually, like, by coming to Krishna consciousness, has like flourished more. But I'm just saying, like, maybe let Krishna also work it out how much, you know, they want to, you want to tell them to let go of that and let go of this. Sorry, that's all I can think of.
Just while you were speaking, just something also occurred, or I thought of that. Maybe a good measure is also, like, along with whatever, you know, natural attachment or attraction they have to worshipping Krishna, if we can also see that the detachment from the material things, the adherence to the principles of bhakti yoga, you know, the regulation, if all of that is simultaneously happening along with whatever natural spontaneous attraction that they have, then there's no problem with that natural spontaneous attraction. But if that natural spontaneous attraction isn't leading to a detachment from the other things or a following of the principles, then we could maybe assume that it's more sentimental than...
Yeah.
And so maybe a preacher can keep an eye on that and see that if this person is naturally following the principles of spiritual life, even if they have some, because ultimately you want to become attached to Krishna in a natural way. So that's not maybe so much the problem, but what the problem is if you have it and simultaneously have material attachments, then it can almost seem a bit sahajya.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely, yeah. Prajan Prabhu?
I just wanted to speak about a little experience that came when we had a school program here. There was the children, they must have been about 7-8 years old, and there was a little boy in the toilet area. He came over to me, you know, and he said it was, and I saw him, and then he was looking in the mirror and he was trying to get this paint off his face. And he was getting desperate to get it off, you know. And he was nearly sort of like crying. And I said, hold on, let me see if I can help you. And he just stood there, and he was about 7. And I got this little cloth and started sort of trying to get the paint off him. An interesting thing happened then. But because he just stood there in all innocence, in a sort of a helpless state, as I was taking it off, a strange feeling of paternal feelings happened, that I was looking after him, and that I felt that he was just, it was just because I was his assistant, and that, like, he was my helpless child. Some paternal feelings just started to blossom in me. He just stood there, you know, and he let me do it. You know, he was in a helpless state, and I felt these paternal feelings.
was the most unusual experience. So it actually, you can see what happens if we behave in such a manner in the situations. Paternal feelings start to arise when a person starts to be on the receiving end like a helpless child. He was, you know. I don't know if that made any sense to anybody, but certainly just in Indra's all his innocence, then instantly I was his dad, you know, and I was trying to help him out, and he was just needed looking after. Yeah, it was an interesting experience, but it was just, he wasn't my time, and it wasn't anything to do, but the feelings are there. As part of our nature, it occurs to me anyway, that it can happen in any situation with any child that you look after, and you become a child, you know, you build up a relationship. It just happens, you know, like a parent, like a brother or whatever, you know. These feelings arise, and they're part of our nature in Krishna consciousness. You know, these relationships can spontaneously come. You know, and they may not be your brother, but
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't know if that made any sense.
No, it does very much. Yeah, thank you, Prabhuji. Ian, I think this will be the last one.
Hare Krishna, thank you so much for the class. I just had a question. So, you know, you mentioned, you know, Mother Yashoda's superiority came from the fact that Krishna's, you know, opulence and his position did not come into consideration in regards of how she related to him. And now for us, as we're engaging in devotional service, the basis of us actually choosing devotional service is because we've understood that position. Of Krishna being the supreme, Krishna is Krishna, and so we're rendering devotional service unto him because that's who he is. So for us developing, you know, to this stage, that's not a point we can ever reach, in the sense that we always know that Krishna is the supreme. Or is it that once we reach that stage, we will forget that Krishna is the supreme and serve him in that pure state?
No. See, we have to worship Krishna as supreme. Even if you look at the deity worship we're doing here, we're doing it in Vishnu Bhav, right? We're not doing it in, like, look, just so, right? Opulent, we have like 2 hours worth of deity worship every day, or more so, actually, in, right? No. We have to worship Krishna based on tattva right now. Remember, this is rasa. We are nowhere near rasa. We have no idea about what our rasa is with Krishna. That will come once we've completely gone past, you know, anartha nivritti, nishta, you know, ruchi, asakti, whatever, you know, like when we're completely on that coming to bhav prema, then, you know, we will start to have like a personal relationship with Krishna. And that relationship may be devoid of opulence or with opulence, whatever it may be.
But we still have that fact, we know that he's a supreme.
Yeah.
Before
we get to rasa, there has to be tattva first. Like, for example, the example is given that, I gave the example of Gladstone and the grandkids, and how the grandkids were riding horseback on Gladstone. Now, the grandfather is more superior to the grandchild. That tattva is there. That is already established between Gladstone and his grandkids, right? He's the superior one. He's the powerful one. The grandkids. But now that tattva is established, then you can play around with the rasa, where the grandkid now climbs on the grandfather's back and stuff, where supposedly being superior now, right? But the tattva was first established there, right? So same way, we are in the process where we first have to establish tattva, because we don't realize Krishna is the supreme yet. We need to first get that down, and that will probably take most of our lives. And then, once we've gone past that, then our rasas, whatever they may be, whether it's in this life or after we leave this body or whatever, you know, yeah. Yeah, first things first, yes. Tattva comes first, then the rasa. All right. Thank you very much. Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki.